legs went weak when she was climbing, and she almost fell. The doctor offered his hand to her, and Sebastian supported her from the rear. I saw all this from the road where I was hiding. I wanted to do for them what Joel had done for me, but I didn't. I couldn't. Even in the river, with Wilner, I couldn't. The thought came to me that I should swim across the river again, collect his body to be buried on this side. All the soldiers, all the guns, I couldn't. I have not been able to do for anyone what Joel did for me, and I never will. No, never. Because the more I see people die, the more I want to guard my own life. I reached over and placed my hand on his sweaty, trembling leg to keep him quiet, to keep him still. My fingers crept up his thighs with his hands guiding mine. I felt for his face in the dark and touched his large Adam's apple, which bobbed up and down as though about to slide out of his mouth. He turned over on his side and slipped my nightdress off my shoulders. For a while, we both lay on our backs, staring at the darkness above us. What now? What then? Who else did we know to turn to? It could have been me too at the church with Mimi and Sebastian, I said. If I hadn't noticed two bloody spots on the back of the Signora's dress and stayed a while longer with her. And maybe Odette died in the river because I pressed down on her nose too hard, though this was not my intention. Odette died when Wilner died, he said. They killed her when they killed him. And for this I was grateful, more grateful than he knew. His body immediately leaped up to meet mine when I climbed on top of him. I was probably lighter than he expected, bonier and smaller framed than he'd thought. For a while, I felt as though he was carrying me, the way Signora Valencia had carried her son and daughter in her womb. The way Congo might have carried his son Joel after he'd died. The way first he and then the stranger had carried Odette. Then it was me carrying him. After a while, it was as though we were both afloat at the same time, joined in a way that we could never be speaking together or even crying together. For several months, as I'd imagined Sebastian's return, I'd wondered whether my flesh could feel anything but pain. Perhaps Eve had wondered the same about his own. His breathing was loud and fast, like the vapor raising the lid off a steaming pot. Then his body froze abruptly and became heavier, and I thought that his heart had stopped, that he had died right there on top of me. He ground his teeth and mumbled to himself, trying to push out everything that wanted to remain safely hidden in him. In the end, all he let out was a flash flood of tears. Tears that rolled down my forehead, stung my eyes, made me sneeze when they slipped into my nostrils, and tasted like my own when they fell on my tongue. As he rolled back on his side of the bed, I felt an even larger void in the aching pit of my stomach. I put on my nightdress and slipped under the sheets. He stepped off the bed, put on his pants, and went outside, leaving the door half open. Sitting under the traveler's tree, he examined the sky and opened a new pack of La Nationale cigarettes. In the moonlight, I could almost see the silhouette of bones pushing themselves out in his bark. After smoking a few of the cigarettes, he threw the rest of the pack against the side of the house and came back inside. When he climbed onto the bed, I pretended to be asleep, or even dead.
35. The next afternoon,
When I went back to Mande Nisa's house, the doors were bolted shut and one of the girls who had been looking after her told me that Mande Nisa had buried some coffee beans in the yard and then returned to her people in Port-au-Prince. "Do you know where in Port-au-Prince our people live?" I asked. She shook her head no, turned her back to me, and looked towards the lime-colored hills on the other side of the house. Maybe she was tired of being taught the same thing in so many ways, the girl said. Might be she went someplace where only her children would find her, if they come back. She was mending a blouse that didn't need mending at all, something she was making smaller to fit her own body. I offered to fix the blouse for her, but she would not let it out of her hands. So I watched as she stitched her uneven seams and sewed it too narrow for her shape. "Better you go," she said. "She is never coming back to this house. Her people will travel from Port-au-Prince to sell the house," is what she said. "But she herself will never set her foot here again." The girl tore out the new seams she had sewn for the blouse and started making darts in the lining. I wished I could have been with Mande Nisa much longer. I wish I could have done more for her. But some sorrows were simply too individual to share. "Better you go now," the girl said. So I went to the Cap's Cathedral, where a late afternoon mass was being held. A group of consecrants lined up to accept the Eucharist at the feet of a giant crucifix that was bleeding crimson paint for blood. I stood in the back near a slanted wall of votive candles and watched the whole assembly march to the altar and then back up again, crossing themselves and bowing to the crucifix one last time before they turned their backs to it. A woman slipped in next to me with her hands outstretched toward the candles and a transparent window of La Vierge, whose dress was made of sun, sieved through blue glass. "No communion for you?" she asked, looking away from the Virgin's downcast eyes. "No communion," I said. "No confession?" "No confession. Even as you say one simple word," she said, with an open-mouthed smile. "I know the sound of your talk. Did you just return?" "Some time ago," I said. "Me too. Some time ago," she said. "I used to have a little trade of my own, selling things there, but now I work for the priests here, cleaning the church and cooking for them." I looked her over for a mark, a scar, some damage that I could see. She was looking at my legs, wondering perhaps if that was the only way in which I'd been hurt. "Where did you live there?" she asked. "Alegria," I said. "Never went there," she said. "Where did you live?" I asked her. "Igwe," she said. "Was it cane country where you were?" "Small cane, small mills. The place where you lived, is Alegria what it was called officially, or did our people christen it this way?" "I've always heard it called this," I said. "People I was with, they'd christen places, and the name they gave these places nobody outside knew." "Was there much joy where you were, that they'd call it Alegria?" For as long as I could remember, people had always called the cluster of rich homes and mountains, streams and cane fields that surrounded Senora Valencia's house, Alegria. "Maybe the people who called it this were jesting," I said. She let out a laugh too noisy for any sacred place. "You here to talk to the priest about the slaughter?" she asked. "Father Emile, he's the one who listens to the stories." She pointed out Father Emile. He was the shorter and fatter of the two priests standing at the altar. The other one was older, French and white, with hair like a mare's forelock falling into his eyes. "You'll have to wait some," she said, "until after the mass, and all the alms are given for the day. After the Mass, the priests went out on the steps in front of the cathedral and distributed bread to the poor waiting outside. The woman ran to a back room and came out with two rolls of bread. She placed them in my hand without a word, so I would not be shamed by accepting them. As the fathers walked past us on the way back inside, she grabbed Father Emil's cassock and said, "Father, this one here has been waiting a long time to see you." Father Emil looked down at the bread in my hand and gave me a nod of pity. The woman pressed her hands against my back and shoved me towards him. I followed him to a room behind the altar. The room had a wide desk, two cane-backed chairs, a small cross on the wall, and a glass case full of books for the school the priests ran behind the church.
"You've come to talk about the slaughter?"
he asked, offering me one of the fragile cane-backed chairs. He slipped behind the desk and sat down.
"To all those who tell us of lost relations, we can offer nothing, save for our prayers and perhaps a piece of bread. So we have stopped letting them tell us these terrible stories. It was taking all our time, and there's so much other work to be done."
"Father, I have not come to tell you a tale," I said, "and I've already received a piece of bread."
"Then how can I be of service to you, my child?"
"I want to know if you have heard of Father Woman or Father Vargas, who lived and served on the other side of the river." He joined his hands together and pushed his body forward towards my chair.
"In churches all over this land, we have prayed for them," he said, glancing up at the simple cross on the wall behind me. "Word of their struggle has reached us through our other brothers in the faith."
He seemed pleased that there was at least something he could do for me.
"So they are not dead?" "They suffered much in prison, but they are still alive. Some members of the church approached the Generalissimo on their behalf, and they were both liberated. After he was released, Father Oman was asked to leave the other side, even though he wanted to stay and help those of our people who have remained there."
I reached across the desk and squeezed his joined hands.
"Did you know them?" he asked.
"I did know them, yes.
Father Roman is living near the border, in Wanamint, in a tiny shack with his young sister, not a nun, a blood sister."
He smiled.
"A singer. The house is near an old grange where a clinic was erected during the crisis. He wanted to be as close to his old parish as possible."
"You are a miracle, Father," I said, kissing the still warm rolls of bread rather than him.
36. That night, I wrote a simple note to give to Father Woman if I saw him. My words were written for Dr. Javier, who, if he was not still in prison, might visit Father Woman at the border. "Por favor, Dr. Javier, I would be most grateful for your guidance as to where to find Micheline Onius and Sebastian Onius, who are said to have perished in Santiago at the time of the slaughter, desiring to know if you have seen and know this to be true. Signed, Amabel Desi." I added the location of Man Rapadou's house, along with the street number of the merchant on the quay who sold us most of our sugar and flour. If Dr. Javier was ever handed my note, he would know where to find me. When Eve came to bed that night, he kept himself on the far end of the mattress and took great pains for our skins not to touch. Before he fell asleep, I told him I would be going to the border the next day to visit Father Woman. The following morning, he started early for the fields, but left 10 gourds with his mother, some of it for me to pay for the camion to take me there. During the journey back to the border, I was struck by the size and beauty of the mountains, their hip-like shapes becoming clearer as we drove alongside them. The camion stopped in front of a field of dust-feathered grass surrounding the grange where the old makeshift clinic had been. As I approached the grounds where the dead and wounded had lain, I thought of Odette, and my stomach churned. The ground was slipping beneath my feet. The sun seemed to be moving closer until I felt like it was stationed next to my face, melting my skin and blinding my eyes. The rocks on the ground became as large as pillows, and finally I fell, making of the earth a warm bed. I knew I should call for help, but there was no one coming and going, alive or dead. Besides, I felt so rested, I did not want to be disturbed. Above me spun a sky full of grass, and the planks nailed in twos across the grange door. I remembered once when I was a girl, watching an infant boy my mother and father had midwifed into this world. A month later, the mother left the boy with us when she went to market. While he was sleeping, he rolled himself into a ball and spun around on the bed. I watched him do this for some time before I called for my father, who was cutting wood outside, and my mother, who was washing clothes behind the house. "I think this baby has the evil in him," I told him. My father laughed and slapped the little boy's bottom, which made him stop his spasms. Then he explained, my father, that sometimes in the first year, babies remembered their births with their bodies and had to repeat it many times before they could forget. When they did this, you were to help them recollect the whole thing, especially their coming out, by tapping them on their bottom as had been done to them after their birth. Sometime later, I woke up and stumbled to my feet. Miraculously, I had not hurt myself. I wiped my face with the back of both hands and walked to a limestone house in the distance, a solitary lodging in a large open field. An old woman sat crouched in the doorway, shelling peas on her lap. Her thumbs dashed in and out of the soft green pods, thrusting out perfectly round green peas into a half-filled bowl. "I've come to see Father Woman," I said. She pointed down the field to a box-like clapboard shack with a zinc roof. The front door was open, but I knocked anyway. A young woman came to the door, wearing a flowered sundress, the top of which barely covered her small flat breasts. She was fanning her face with two long flame tree pods that made a haphazard melody as she waved them back and forth. "Is Father Woman here?" I asked. "Who wants him?" She continued to swing the pods, making it hard for me to hear her voice above the clatter. "They call me Amabel," I said. "I knew him in Alegria." Swinging the pods even harder, she said, "I do this when I'm not in view of my brother, so he knows where I am. It comforts him." Stepping out of the doorway, she motioned for me to walk inside. "Do not be saddened if he does not remember you," she said. "So many people have come to him asking about their relations. But when he was arrested, he was always kept with the other priest, Father Vargas. He was never with the Haitian prisoners." She stopped the rattling and led me through a bare room, then out to the yard, where Father Woman was sitting on a rocker beneath a cluster of mango trees. "Jacques," she shouted, "you have a visitor, someone who knew you in Alegria." Father Woman was wearing a straw hat that covered most of his face. A thicket of sable hair peeped through the open collar of his long roomy shirt. His hands trembled as he squinted, fumbling to tie a piece of thin orange paper around the skeleton of a small kite. When his jaws quivered, he reached up and stroked his cheek to control the twitching.
"Who has come?"
he muttered. Spittle was glistening from either side of his mouth. Though still young, he had the look of those who no longer recognized anything, people for whom life was blending into one large shadow, their vision clouding over as they surrendered their sight to very old age. The sister left the yard, went into the room, and brought out another set of chairs. Father Woman's eyes traveled up and down, from the trunk of the mango trees, and then back to his sister, before he saw me. "Speak loudly and tell him what you must tell him," she said. "His mind wanders." "Father, my name is Amabel Desir," I said.
"Yes, Amabel Desir."
His voice was a distant mumble as he held the kite up to his face.
"Father, do you recognize me?"
He shook his head from side to side.
"You don't remember me?"
"No," he said.
"Father, I need to know if perhaps you encountered Mimi and Sebastian Onius before or after you were in prison."
The priest shook his head from behind the kite.
"Prison? Oui, oui. I encountered many people in prison."
"See how they aged him in prison," his sister said.
"Our country is the proudest birthright I can leave them,"
babbled Father Woman. He was staring up blankly at his sister, as if trying with all his powers of understanding to make out her words and mine too.
"They forced him to say these things that he says now whenever his mind wanders," she explained. "On this island, walk too far in either direction and people speak a different language," continued Father Woman with aimless determination. "Our motherland is Spain. Theirs is darkest Africa, you understand? They once came here only to cut sugar cane, but now there are more of them than there will ever be cane to cut, you understand? Our problem is one of dominion. Tell me, does anyone like to have their house flooded with visitors, to the point that the visitors replace their own children? How can a country be ours if we are in smaller numbers than the outsiders? Those of us who love our country are taking measures to keep it our own."
"I cannot stop him once he begins," the sister said, using her bare fingers to wipe the growing puddle of drool on either side of her brother's chin.
"Sometimes I cannot believe that this one island produced two such different peoples."
Father Woman continued like a badly wound machine.
"We, as Dominicans, must have our separate traditions and our own ways of living. If not, in less than 3 generations, we will all be Haitians. In 3 generations, our children and grandchildren will have their blood completely tainted unless we defend ourselves now. You understand?"
Perhaps finally tired of talking, he stopped and lowered his face, his chin down to his chest. "He was beaten badly every day," the sister said, stroking his shoulder. "When he first came, he told me they'd tied a rope around his head and twisted it so tight that sometimes he felt like he was going mad. They offered him nothing to drink but his own piss. Sometimes he remembers everything. Sometimes he forgets all of it, everything, even me."
"Forget," mumbled Father Woman.
He went back to concentrating on improving his kite. With more strength than I'd expect his trembling hands to have, he ripped a piece off the front end of his shirt to make a longer tail for the kite.
"Non, Jacques,"
his sister scolded, like a young mother correcting an errant child. "He's ruined many of his shirts this way," she said, turning back to me. "Did you know Dr. Javier at all?"
I asked his sister.
Jacques, do you remember a Dr. Javier?
She asked. Father Roman tied the strip of cloth from his shirt to the end of his kite and said nothing.
I didn't know all of Jacques' friends, the sister said. He is a priest. I am a singer and not a singer of religious songs.
How long will you stay here? I asked her.
As long as he wants to be here, she said. Where do you live?
In Cap Haitien, I said, at the house of a woman they call Man Rapadou.
Our family has a fine house in Cap Haitien, near the cathedral, she said. I hope he will let me take him there soon. Even in this state, Jacques still wants to go back across the border to find the people he served in that little valley town. But he will be killed if he crosses again.
The sister shook the flame tree pots once more.
Father Roman looked up, his eyes suddenly gleaming like a hungry dog being called to a long-awaited meal. When I said goodbye to him, he greeted me again as though he was seeing me for the first time. I pressed my missive into his sister's hands.
Please, give this to him during one of those times when he remembers, I said.
As I left his house, I wanted but could not bring myself to visit the river. Instead, I dreamt of walking out of the world, of spending all my time inside with no one to talk to, and no one to talk to me. All I wanted was a routine, a series of sterile acts that I could perform without dedication or effort, a life where everything was constantly the same, where every day passed exactly like the one before. That night in bed, I told Eve that I had seen Father Roman at the border.
Don't you think I have gone there too?
He asked.
Don't you think I have seen him, the poor Bekeke?
Please, don't call him that, I said.
Did you see what state he was in? Talking like that without stopping? His sister was the one who told me first that all the killings were meant to look as if they had been done by farmers with machetes. No rifles were ever intended to be fired, as was done with Wilner. Why didn't you tell me you had gone to see him?
Do you know that Mande Nise is gone? That people have been coming to tell her that Mimi and Sebastian are dead?
I don't always tell you what I know or where I go, he said.
His silence before he fell asleep was weighted with rage and guilt. Like Sebastian, he had always lived for work. The two most important cycles of their lives were the cane harvest and the dead season. Now, all he could do was plant and sow to avoid the dead season.
37.
The dead season is, for me, one never-ending night. I dream all the time of returning to give my testimony to the river, the waterfall, the justice of the peace, even to the Generalissimo himself. A border is a veil not many people can wear. The valley is a daydream, the village, the people, and Joël with a grave that only a broken-hearted old man would ever know how to find. I would go back with Odette to say her Pessi to the Generalissimo, for I would not know how to say it myself. My way of saying it would always be, however badly, Perejil. For somewhere in me, I still believe that perhaps one simple word could have saved all our lives. I had never desired to run away. I knew what was happening, but I did not want to flee. Where to? Who to? Was always chiming in my head. Of all the people killed, I will wager that there were many asking like me, who to? Even when they were dying, and the priests were standing over them reciting ceremonial farewells, they must have been asking themselves, go in peace. But where? Heaven, my heaven, is the veil of water that stands between my parents and me. To step across it and then come out is what makes me alive. Odette and Wilner not coming out is what makes them dead. I was never naive or blind. I knew. I knew that the death of many was coming. I knew that the streams and rivers would run with blood. I knew as well how to say Pessi, as to say Perejil. You may be surprised what we use our dreams to do, how we drape them over our sight and carry them like amulets to protect us from evil spells. My dreams are now only visitations of my words for the absent justice of the peace, for the Generalissimo himself. He asked for Perejil, but there's much more we all knew how to say. Perhaps one simple word would not have saved our lives. Many more would have to, and many more will. The more days go by, the more I think of Joelle's grave, of Wilner's, Odette's, Mimi's, and Sebastian's too. I could no more find these graves than the exact star that exploded and fell from the sky the night each of them perished. The more I think about their graves, the more I see mine. A simple stone marker with written on it only my name and the day I die. But it must be known that I understood. I saw things too. I just thought they would not see me. I just thought they would not find me. Only when Mimi and Sebastian were taken did I realize that the river of blood might come to my doorstep, that it had always been in our house, that it is in all our houses. I once heard an elder say that the dead who have no use for their words leave them as part of their children's inheritance. Proverbs, teeth suckings, obscenities, even grunts and moans, once inserted in special places during conversations, all are passed along to the next heir. I hear the weight of the river all the time. It creaks beneath the voices, like a wooden platform under a ton of mountain rocks. The river, it opens up to swallow all who step in it, men, women, and children alike, as if they had bellies full of stones. It is perhaps the great discomfort of those trying to silence the world, to discover that we have voices sealed inside our heads, voices that with each passing day grow even louder than the clamor of the world outside. The slaughter is the only thing that is mine enough to pass on. All I want to do is find a place to lay it down now and again, a safe nest where it will neither be scattered by the winds nor remain forever buried beneath the sod. I just need to lay it down sometimes, even in the rare silence of the night with no faces around. 38. I waited for Dr. Javier's reply by watching Eve leave for the fields every morning to return home after dark. I waited for Dr. Javier's reply by feeling my wider, heavier body slowly fold towards my feet, as though my bones were being deliberately pulled from their height towards the ground. I waited for Dr. Javier's reply by sewing clothes for everyone who came with a piece of cloth and held it in front of me and for my effort, offered me a few gourds, a plate of food, and sometimes nothing but a kind grin. Yes, I waited for Dr. Javier's reply by growing old. His sister had moved Father Woman to a hospital in Port-au-Prince, so I didn't see him again until May 1961, after the Generalissimo was killed in a monsoon of bullets as he was being driven out of the capital city on a highway named after him. Father Woman was in the captain for a family event and came to stand out in the sun on the cathedral steps and watch a parade of survivors singing on the street. Yo tiye kabuitla, aje. They killed the goat,
âgé.
It was the first time since the crowds waiting for the justice of the peace that I had seen a group remembering, a strange celebration of the living and the dead, the children and grandchildren of the slaughter. Father Woman had been forced to age faster than most of us, but I could tell under his hollowed cheekbones and high round bounty of salt and pepper hair that he was experiencing his own share of uncertain joy. He seemed like a different person, the older brother, no, the grandfather, of the man he once was, the man who had taught the children about the properties of the wind and the invisible substances in the air by flying kites. I didn't know where the sister was that day, but she was not with him or with us. Those of us who took to the once fire-engulfed streets of the Cap to clank pots and cans and sing to celebrate the Generalissimo's passing. Eve came home from the fields to wander in and out of the small crowd, nibbling at his lower lip as though he wanted to weep for every scream of our happiness. Man Rapadu and I walked arm in arm, her body nimble and spry, as she entered the last years of her seventh decade. Man Rapadu had been essential to me in the simple routine of my life. We'd wake up together, at the same time every morning after Eve had left for the fields, and she would help me with my sewing. I treasured my sewing. I enjoyed feeling my index finger cramped inside the thimble, found many hours pleasure in watching the needle rise and fall, guarding the fragile thread with caution as it snaked through the cloth. I never used machines, because that would have taken away a great part of the physical enjoyment. Every morning at dawn, Man Rapadu and some of the women from the yard would go to market and bring back fresh ingredients for a meal that wasn't ready until late afternoon, closer to the time when Eve came home. Even though she knew he ate elsewhere, or maybe even had another woman looking after him, she still treated him like he was her helpless boy who had just enough strength to make his father's land come alive. As his fortune had grown, Eve had added 4 more rooms to the courtyard, 2 of them mine and mine alone. His mother did not want to move elsewhere and leave her old relations and happy sad memories behind. There were times when I shut myself in those 2 rooms that were mine and took to my bed for months. Times when I had too much lint in my throat or an aching arm that prevented me from sewing, when the joint of my knee would throb and the ringing in my ears would chime without stop. Other than those moments, the Generalissimo's death was the only reprieve from my routine of sewing and sleeping and having the same dreams every night.
"Oh, man, Amabel, look at you doing the calanda!"
someone called out from the crowd in front of the cathedral. I didn't even realize I'd been dancing. Didn't even know I could dance. Still, it wasn't the compliment I heard, but the title belonging to an elder. A man, like Man Irel, Man Denis, or Man Rapadu, before my name. I saw young men and women leaping with maracas and tambourines that day, who were not yet born when I'd returned, and I felt time slither around me in a way it didn't when I was alone with Man Rapadu and her people in the courtyard. Eve walked ahead of all of us, staying out of the crowd spilling over into the shops. He seemed younger than he was, with a sunken chest and narrow waist. He looked like he had lived through 1 or 2 famines. He had gone back to shaving his head bald, even though he no longer had any reason to fear collecting cane ticks in his hair. He was not pleased with us for taking part in the instant parade, I could tell. He spoke so little now that I could read whole phrases on his sweaty, knotted brows. The questions posed on his face that day were ones I was also asking myself. How dare you dance on a day like this? What could we do but dance?
It's like dancing on all the graves.
There were no graves, no makas. If we tried to dance on graves, we would be dancing on air.
Besides, this was a harmless, effortless dance, one our people knew well, the dance of farewell to a departed tyrant. For 24 years, all of my conversations with Eve had been restricted to necessary prattle. Good morning, good night, what goes, goodbye. The careful words exchanged between people whose mere presence reminds each other of a great betrayal. I had often hoped that he would find a woman to love him and take him away from the courtyard. I couldn't escape myself because I had nowhere else to go. I didn't have the strength to travel in search of distant relations whose lives had gone well enough without me. I didn't even know if they would recognize me if they saw me. Some of them might have come looking for me after my parents drowned, but maybe they thought I had drowned too. So in spite of the solemn expressions on many of the faces in the crowd, in spite of those who wept, even as they were dancing, in spite of the dead whose absence trailed us as did the dust of their bones in the wind, even as our chanters vanished, of ever glaring and spitting into his eyes, we were still having a celebration, if only because the Generalissimo was dead, and we had survived. After the crowd had thinned out, I walked up the steps in front of the cathedral, leaving Man Rabadou and Eve to wait for me on the sidewalk. Father Woman was standing with a group of parishioners walking out of the cathedral.
Mon père, you are better?
I asked from the outer row of the group.
By his grace, yes.
His voice was as tranquil as his eyes were suddenly attentive, the two most visible signs of the young man he had once been.
I am Amabel Daisy, Father, I said. I came to see you when you were in Wanamint. I lived in Alegria. How is your sister?
You knew my sister?
He asked.
Yes, I saw her in your house in Wanamint.
She still sings in nightclubs in Port-au-Prince.
He extended his right hand to me, watching it rise from his side as though his own flesh was a marvel to him still.
Father, will you return to Alegria now?
Someone asked. He seemed surprised that so many others knew about Alegria. Alegria, a name to evoke joy, he said, his voice rising as if for a group before a pulpit.
Perhaps this is what its founders, those who named it, had in mind. Perhaps there had been joy for them in finding that sugar could be made from blood.
Even Man Rabadou climbed the steps and went to sit inside the cool cathedral. Eve did not even look at Father Woman as he walked by, supporting his mother's steps by holding onto her elbow.
Father, will you return to Alegria?
Another person asked the question again. Father Woman looked down at our group, as though we had just planted the seed of this idea in his head.
Yes, I will return, he said, to help those of our people who are still there if I can.
When will you return, Father?
I asked.
I am no longer a father, he said, then corrected himself. I am a father to 3 young boys. I am no longer with any order.
Why, Father?
The question escaped from an unguarded mouth.
It took more than prayers to heal me after the slaughter, he said, with a sadness that he was too distraught to show when I first saw him at the border.
It took holding a pretty and gentle wife and 3 new lives against my chest. I wept so much when they arrested me. I wept all the time I was in prison. I wept at the border. I wept for everyone who was touched, beaten, or killed. It took a love closer to the earth, closer to my own body, to stop my tears.
Perhaps I have lost, but I have also gained an even greater understanding of things, both godly and earthly.
39.
That night, I watched from my front room as Eve sat under a newer, almost grown traveler's palm, which he had brought there and planted himself in the same spot as the old one that had withered and died. He was reclining on a rocking chair with a bottle of rum in his hand, looking ahead at nothing in particular, except maybe the fireflies that lit themselves in unison as they circled him. The slaughter had affected him in certain special ways. He detested the smell of sugarcane, except the way it disappeared in rum, and loathed the taste of parsley. He could not swim in rivers. The sound of Spanish being spoken, even by Isians, made his eyes widen, his breath quicken, his face cloud with terror, his lips unable to part one from the other and speak. Over the years, his father's land had grown into more than 2 dozen hectares of bean fields. The more he produced, the more land he bought. His family now owned rice paddies, sorghum and wheat plots, coffee, cacao, and yam lots. He had also built himself a cinder block workhouse near a creek where he consulted with his workers, ate his midday meals, and took siestas during the late afternoons. The creek itself was surrounded with mango, avocado, and papaya trees, under which roamed guinea fowls and wild pigeons that everyone in the area was free to hunt, just as they were to help themselves to the ripening fruits on all of Eve's trees. In his mother's old racado, he was simply a poor man alone, sipping from a bottle of the Gardère family's Réserve du Domaine, and dozing off now and again between glances at the sky. Before swallowing a mouthful, he would spill the costly rum on the ground, forming a circle of bubbled dust for the ones we don't see, the untouchables, the invisibles. He and I both had chosen a life of work to console us after the slaughter. We had too many phantoms to crowd those quiet moments when every ghost could appear in its true form and refuse to go away. As I sat on a white plastic bucket and watched him from my doorway, I regretted that we hadn't found more comfort in each other. After I realized that Sebastian was not coming back, I wanted to find someone who would both help me forget him and mourn him with me. Perhaps this was too great a gift to ask of a man who was in search of the same thing for himself. The plastic bucket slipped out from beneath me as I got up. Eve turned around and watched me stumble, trying to maintain my balance on my bad knee. By the time he reached me, I was already on my feet. He let go of my hand and walked back to the rocking chair, picked up the bottle of rum, and went into his room. Once he went, Man Rapadu crossed the yard and came to my sewing room. She had a cold compress on her forehead and was trying to keep drips of water from sliding into her eyes. She dropped her wide body down on a long skirt, to which I was adding some last pleats before going to bed. "Man Rapadu, you are not sleeping well?" I asked. "It's all this walking in the sun today," she said. "I should not have walked so long in the sun today." "Are you sick?" "Not sick, but very tired." She lay back on my bed, which was a plain cotton mattress kept purposely low, close to the ground. "Amabel, my life, like yours, has always been rich with dreams," she said. "My head barely touches the pillow at night when I dream that I'm falling." "Falling?" "I dream often that I am falling," she said. "And they get bigger, the things I'm falling from. First, I am an infant falling out of my mother's body. Then I'm falling off my mother and father's house, a wooden house in the middle of a coffee grove. Then it's the house of Eve's father I'm falling from. Then I'm falling off little hills and cliffs. Then it's mountains. I'm falling off mountains. The next thing to fall from after mountain is the clouds, no?
When you fall, where do you come to land? I asked. Perhaps it was an unnecessary question, but one I needed an answer to prepare myself for the time when I would be having these same kinds of dreams myself.
I always wake up before I come to land, she said, even if I see myself getting closer to the ground every day.
What do you make of this type of dream?
When I was a girl, she said, searching with her coarse bent fingers for the contour of her own face, now buried under many layers of crow's feet and wrinkles. My skin was so dry that sometimes it peeled off in scabs pink with bloat, like fish scales. I was very clumsy because my feet were weak, but I knew how to slip into a fall, how to not fight the force of the earth pulling me down. When I became a young woman, somehow, my feet got stronger, and I never thought about falling again until now. I tried to gather her into my arms, which was impossible to do given the breadth of her figure, so I patted the flesh on her back, between her neck and her waist, as if burping a growing child. It's a hard thing to know that life will go on one day without you, she said. I too felt and lived my own body's sadness more and more every day. The old and new sorrows were suddenly inconsolable, and I knew that the brief moments of joy would not last forever. When I saw a beautiful young man, I tried to pair him up with my younger self. I dreamed of the life without pain that he might have brought me, the tidy parlor and spotless furnishings that our young children would not be allowed to touch, except to dust off on Saturdays. Old age is not meant to be survived alone, Man Rapadu said, her voice trailing with her own hidden thoughts. Death should come gently, slowly, like a man's hand approaching your body. There can be joy in impatience if there's time to find the joy. How long has it been, Man Rapadu, since a man touched your big belly? I asked to make her laugh. Not as long as since one had touched yours, she said, measuring the length of her own smile with the edge of her fingertips. From time to time, life takes you by surprise. You sit in your laku eating mangoes. You let the mango seeds fall where they may. And one day you wake up, and there's a mango tree in your yard. I knew she meant this as a compliment to me, a kind word for my sudden arrival at her house some years before. I have not told this to anyone, she said, her hands patting her two white hips. But I believe there are many who suspect, even my son. The Yankees had poisoned Eve's father's mind when he was in their prisons here. He was going to spy on others for Yankee money after he left their jail. Many people who were against the Yankees being here were going to die because of his betrayal. And so, I cooked his favorite foods for him and filled them with flour, fine glass, and rat poison. I poisoned him. Maybe this is why I am falling in all my dreams. I'm going to him soon and I'm afraid. What will I say to him in the life after? Love is only pleasure, honor is duty. I cannot simply say this thing that I told myself then. It is not enough now. I should not tell you this about me. You might do the same to my son. But then you do not love him like I did Eve's father. But greater than my love for this man was love for my country. I could not let him trade us all, sell us to the Yankees.
I often hear that silence is holiness, and still I'm not holy," she said, wiping a tear from the side of her face. "I believed then that fortune would favor the brave. How young I was. There are cures for everything except death. I wish the sun had set on my days when I was still a young, happy woman, whose man was by her side, with joys in his eyes and Anna in his heart." The next morning, I left Man Rabadu asleep, with her sorrows in my bed, to go climb upon a mule to the uneven cobblestone road that led to the citadel. There, on the outer galleries, I walked among a group of tourists who were wandering through, photographing the barracks, the stone walls, the rusting artillery, and the vaulted ceilings. Using broken phrases in various tongues, local boys offered themselves as guides for individual tours through the interior corridors. One of the special guides was a very large Aesian man wearing a long-sleeved white shirt and a black tie. He was leading a group of 12 young white foreigners in beach attire. With a sweep of his fingers, the man guided his group to the edge of a low wall to show them the ruins of the Palais Sans Souci, the king's old official residence down below. Pointing to the goat-gray hills of reddish grass in the direction where my parents' house used to stand, he said, "It was not unusual for people to live here before the constant earthquakes drove most of them away. You could feel even the smallest earthquake in those hills." I couldn't recognize any more any place that resembled where our house had been, nor did I want to. Land is something you care about only when you have heirs. All my heirs would be like my ancestors, revenants, shadows, ghosts. I wasn't certain why I had picked that particular group of white foreigners, an Aesian guide, to follow, until I realized that both the guide's talk and the things that members of the group were whispering to one another were in Spanish. I trailed them to the open courtyard on one of the top tiers of the citadel. It was a place I had always avoided going as a child. In the middle was a raised block of concrete shaped like a coffin, a place sometimes believed to be the grave of Henri I. As the group circled the concrete block, the guide told the story of Henri I. "Henri Christophe was at first a foreigner here," he said. "He was born a slave in the Windward Islands, and during his life made himself a king here." The large man tugged at the end of his tie as he spoke. Then, either to caution his young charges against vainglory or to be fair to history, he added, "The king was sometimes cruel. He used to march battalions of soldiers off the mountain, ordering them to plunge to their deaths, as a disciplinary example to the others. Thousands of our people died constructing what you see here. But this is not singular to him. All monuments of this great size are built with human blood." To make clear his sentiment, he tapped the mortar pile with his fists, reminding the group of the most unforgivable weaknesses of the dead, their absence and their silence. "When the king was 53 years old," he continued, "he had a sudden apoplexy which left him paralyzed. His enemies organized a revolt against him, and rather than surrender, he shot himself with what some say was either a silver or a gold bullet. It is said that he was buried in this palace, many believe in this spot. But there's some mystery as to whether or not he is really under here. He could be anywhere in this palace, or nowhere here at all." As they moved away from the mortar, the man inspected the faces in the group to determine that everyone was still there with him. "Famous men never truly die," he added. "It is only those nameless and faceless who vanish like smoke into the early morning air." 40. This past is more like flesh than air. Our stories, testimonials like the ones never heard by the Justice of the Peace or the Generalissimo himself. His name is Sebastien Onius, and his story is like a fish with no tail, a dress with no hem, a drop with no fall, a body in the sunlight with no shadow. His absence is my shadow, his breath my dreams. New dreams seem a waste, needless annoyances, too much to crowd into the tiny space that remains. Still, I think I want to find new manners of filling up my head, new visions for an old life, waterless rivers to cross and real waterfall caves to slip into over 100 times each day. His name is Sebastien Onius. Sometimes this is all I know. My back aches now in all those places that he claimed for himself. Arches of bare skin that belong to him. Pockets where the flesh remains fragile. Seared like unhealed burns where each fallen scab uncovers a deeper wound. I wish at least that he was part of the air on the side of the river. A tiny morsel in the breeze that passes through my room in the night. I wish at least that some of the dust of his bones could trail me in the wind. Men with names never truly die. It is only the nameless and faceless who vanish like smoke into the early morning air. His name is Sebastien Onius. 7 years before his own death, he saw his father die. Death to Sebastien Onius was as immense as a tree-tossing beast of a raging hurricane. It was an event that split open the sky and cracked the ground, made the heavens wail and the clouds weep. It was not for one person to live alone. Perhaps there was water to greet his last fall, to fold around him and embrace him like a feather-filled mattress. Perhaps there were ceremonial words recited in his ears. Allez avec bon Dieu. Go with God. Go in peace. A farewell not so solitary and abrupt. A parting like the dimming of the twilight, darkening the sky for shadows and stars at play. His name is Sebastien Onius, and his spirit must be inside the waterfall cave at the source of the stream, where the cane workers bathe, the grotto of wet moss and chalk and luminous green fresco, the dark green of wet papaya leaves. Sometimes I can make myself dream him out of the void to listen. A handsome, steel-bodied man, he carries a knapsack woven from palm leaves as he walks out of the cave into the room where I sleep. Amabel, it is Sebastien come to see you, he says. I have brought remedies for your wounds. I've brought citronella and cedarwood to keep the ants and mosquitoes from biting your skin, camphor, basil, and bitter oranges to reduce your fevers and keep your joints limber. I've brought ginger and celery, aniseed and cinnamon for your digestion, turmeric for your teeth, and kowusal tea for pleasant dreams. He stands over my bed, fills his lungs with the cloud of lint in the room. I reach over and try to touch him, but he scatters with my reach, like a stream of dust caught in a strong beam of noontime sunlight. I sense that we no longer know the same words, no longer speak the same language. There's water, wind, land and mountains between us, a shroud of silence, a curtain of fate. Tell me, please, Sebastien, I say, I must know. Did you and Mimi suffer greatly? He breathes in more of the cloth dust in my room, as though he wants to inhale me in everything.